two, three, four. Testing one, two, three, four.
Why don't we ask y'all to start the meeting and just see if we get to fill in. I'm Randy Blykoff, the Associate Commissioner of AIDS and Special Competition at FDA.
Kiyoshi Kuramiya, Critical Pathways Project.
Bill Ballman, ACT UP New York.
Dr. Suzanne Phillips, ACT UP New York, and HIV Primary Care Physician in East Harlem.
Bree Salzman, People with AIDS Coalition of New York.
David Feigl, the Antiviral Drug Division at the FDA.
I'm Maxine Wolf. I'm with ACT UP New York, and done research a lot on women's issues. And I've also been a researcher in my non-active life.
Diana Williamson, I'm a physician in East Harlem, primary care AIDS.
David Robinson from ACT UP New York.
I'm Sean Stroop from POS Magazine. I apologize in advance as I'm going to have to interrupt the meeting to leave in about 40 minutes. And I'll hold over another meeting.
Martin Delaney, Project Reform.
I'm Tom Block, I'm AIDS Survival Project.
Samantha?
Richard Klein from the Office of AIDS Special Health Issues, FDA.
Levon Covington, Office of AIDS.
Ralph Lilly, Interloper.
Don Freeman.
Jeff Murray, Interloper.
Martin Whitmore, Public Affairs Office.
Green Shapiro, Public Affairs.
And on our call.
On the phone.
What do we have in the phone?
Jim and John and who else was it? Jim Driscoll.
Ron Baker is there.
From Beta.
On the phone, can you hear us?
Hello.
Yeah. Could you just do it as a roll call?
Yeah, this is Jeff Getty, ACT UP Golden Gate.
Okay.
This is John James, AIDS Treatment News. And this is Jim Driscoll with Direct Action for Treatment Access.
So Ron Baker and Rich Colvin weren't reachable?
Yes, okay.
I guess not.
Keep working.
Okay, all right.
You weren't particularly like this.
No.
I mean, here.
Bill, I think it's your
view. No.
Well,
you're a good quote. Yeah, that's
think,
tough.
The agenda, as I sort of explained it to Richard Klein, and as was talked about amongst us all, is to basically deal with three issues. One, where what the FDA has been doing in the last couple months in regards to accelerated approval, expanded access, what drug companies have been
prove me right again. I said you were on your way.
Yeah, no. I apologize for being late.
I made up, in addition to the folks in the room on the phone, we have Jim Driscoll, Jeff Getty, and Joe James.
Hi.
Okay, what we wanted to do was put together a presentation and a meeting Dr. Kessel and staff that has a more of a representative field of people around the country and different populations of people with HIV to discuss the issues of accelerated approval, expanded access, and also to learn from your office what has gone down the last couple of months in regards to Hoffman Roche and protease and various other companies that are developing protease, because we're getting a lot of input and from the drug companies as well as from representatives of PEG, that there's been quite a shift already taking place. And we'd like to get a clarification from your office and ask some questions as well as make our presentations on accelerated approval.
Excuse me. In other words, we'd like to sort of start with a fact check here where there's a nationwide controversy, and we'd like to clarify some things because there's a perception that something happened. We would like to clarify what actually did happen as opposed to the way things are being misrepresented or represented and perceived. Okay? So we would probably like to start the meeting by hearing from you folks. What happened in terms of the decision to ask Hoffman LaRoche not to apply for accelerated approval of sequinibir. Specifically, there is a perception that you were strongly influenced by a narrow, a group representing a very narrow position and activist position. And basically, it's being presented that this small group came and greatly influenced your policy, okay? They're representing it that way themselves. You're probably aware faxes of letters that, you know, that were sent, they've made their way across the country. We're all getting copies of just about everything that everybody says or writes every minute. We're sure you're getting the same. So we'd sort of like to find out exactly what did happen. Did TAG influence policy at the national level, claiming to represent people that they do not represent? In fact, try to clarify what, from our standpoint, what's going on for you, and hopefully you can clarify for us what happened.
Well, most importantly, what was said to the drug companies, you know, as to new or different standards for applying for accelerated approval.
Because they're telling us that you said certain things too. So we just want to kind of get to the bottom of things and see what, where the truth, in quotes, lies.
I wonder what the best way is to.
Well, you know that. Yeah, if I could,
if I could start.
Yeah. I mean,
and one facilitational thing, since we have people on the phone, I'm David Robinson from ACT UP New York. Shouldn't we all identify by voice who we are? So
as we speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This is Dr. Suzanne Phillips.
This is David Feigl speaking, FDA. I'm sure you're all aware that the communications between the company and the agency are privileged,
right.
And
right.
So you know we have limitations in terms of what we can say. So it's probably easier for us to outline kind of the broad advice that we give to all companies, and some of which has been presented publicly, and I think it's really hasn't changed, although there's a perception. I think there is one fact that speaks for itself, which is that between the time of the meeting with TAG and now, we have not met with Roche and have not communicated with them about Zequinivir. All the meetings that occurred with them occurred before that meeting to discuss it. if there are claims that that we met with TAG and then met with the company, they've got the sequencing backwards.
You're suggesting there have been no phone contacts even?
Well, I've talked to Weijin Su. I've talked to Weijin Su about upcoming task force meetings and so forth, but we've had no discussions of Zequinivir. And the meetings that the company's had any number of meetings, as all companies do with their products, but all of those occurred before the TAG meetings. So I think
Dr. Feigl, this is Jim Driscoll. Was that TAG meeting the first inkling you had from TAG of their concerns and their positions, or have they been talking to you in ways other than meetings, letters, or phone calls raising these concerns before that meeting?
At the very least, the letter long preceded the meeting. So I guess the question is, to at least backdate it to the letter, is what you're saying still the case?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know I don't know the timing of the letters. Most of these letters go into Randy's office. They don't come into our office, and Randy answers them rather than we do.
This is David Kessler. I think that it's fair to say that we heard from a number of individuals at around the time of the advisory committee for D4T that there were issues about surrogate markers around D4T, and did we need to think about our approach, and there was certainly, I had sensed some concern that among some in the community, a few individuals, that perhaps we were moving too narrowly just by focusing on D4T and dealing with it without dealing with some of the broader questions that had come out of Concord, et cetera. So I think it does, to answer Mr. Driscoll's question, and I certainly, it was around that time where I thought that the first of these kinds of issues, at least I sense, and David, I don't know what you sense, whether you think that's a fair...
No, I think it's fair, and I think the thing that has gradually been evolving over the four accelerated approvals, if you count DDI as the first one, is there's been more attention paid to having the confirmatory trials in place, the trials that would confirm the clinical benefit at the time of the accelerated approval package. And I think you can look for yourselves at the studies that are available on the protease and ask whether that would meet that standard. The other thing which has been true from the start that hasn't been a big issue because all of the companies have easily met it is that there's been, if you look in the discussion of the approval regulations for accelerated approval as they were first promoted, there was a reconfirmation of the need to have more than one trial we've traditionally required two trials, and for many of the accelerated approvals, the large expanded access programs, particularly the randomized dose-finding ones, have served as a large safety database and as a second trial. If you look at what's available at the end of ACTG, my number is 2 through 9, and you look at people on the triple combination, you're dealing with how many patients?
100
per arm and a couple of dropouts. So if you look at what we would normally recommend to a sponsor, and I think we've given the same message to all the sponsors who come in to talk to us, is that you need to have your confirmatory trials fully enrolled. You can take surrogate markers from those trials, as they did with D4T, but have your confirmatory trials fully enrolled and have two trials and have an adequate safety database. And so I think there's any number of reasons why you might expect a package at this at this point in time to not be looked at as very robust with less than 100 patients and very little safety data.
But this is Bree Salzman speaking. The understanding from Merck and the development of their protease inhibitor is that they are not going to go for accelerated approval without more clinical data. Is this because pharmaceutical companies are getting a more conservative message from FDA?
David and Randy and I went up and met with Merck at the announcement of the forming of the intercompany collaboration. And we were talking about methodology on surrogate markers and all of that. And one of the things that the Merck folks said is that we're looking for drug combinations that are so effective that we don't need to bother with weak data. They use the metaphor that's been used so many times, it's getting a little tired. They use the baseball appropriately during the strike metaphor, and really felt that if they could tackle the problem of development of viral resistance, that they may have something that was so much more effective that they wouldn't need these many thousand patient studies to find a marginal difference in progression rates without survival rates. And so that, I don't know if you call that conservatism or optimism, but I think that was their approach then. I don't know if you'd like to comment on that, Randy.
You're David. Not answering my question.
No. Well, are they getting more conservative?
Do they feel that your requirements are going to be more conservative?
Let me just say that in what you just said, I'm Max Hall from New York. In what you just said, you said that they said that rather than have to get thousands of people in a trial, now, as far as I know, that has not been the standard before. So in other words, what they said to you must have been predicated on a belief that the standards have changed already.
Each of the accelerated approvals has had over 5, in some cases over 10, and in some cases over 20,000 patients in trials that have been submitted.
With open access.
With expanded access. Okay.
So that's the sense. And so when I know I'm still not answering your question, but when they say, should we do a large, simple trial, they say, of course not. We're not interested in such small effects. Now, are we telling them they have to have clinical endpoints? No, we are not. We are saying that accelerated approval is still an option, and we ask them still to pursue expanded access.
So this is Bill Baldwin from New York. So when Merck told us last month that the FDA is telling us we need not apply for our NDA until we can show clinical endpoints, they're not speaking the truth.
They should have a confirmatory trial in place. If they have misinterpreted that, then there's room to make that.
When you say confirmatory, you mean post marketing?
Yeah, that's the way accelerated approval works.
Let me address both the Davids on this. Martin Delaney speaking. How is a company to interpret what all of us have seen, which is basically the write up of the meeting that you held with the New York activist group, in which they proposed the model to you of an 18,000 person placebo-controlled trial running 3 to 5 years, and the response that's quoted in their own internal documents on this was that the agency said, you're preaching to the choir here. You don't have to convince us of that. So were I a company, would I not interpret that as something of a signal?
We have already done 12,000 patient, the most recent advisory committee showed a randomized 12,000 patient trial. Not all the patients were available at the time of the analysis, the D4T expanded access trial. That's in the sense that we meant that. But I wouldn't rely on the media to accurately portray our point of view. It would be
This is Bill Baldwin. This is the media of TAG New York.
We're referring to their TAG publication.
Where their, you know, their claims, you know, and their proposal is not for an 18,000 expanded access program.
Not at all.
Their proposal is for an 18,000 placebo-controlled study where 6,000 people get placebo for up to 3 to 5 years.
In place of expanded access.
In place of an expanded access program. And that's the thing that's got the community from coast to coast, from north to south in such an uproar, is because not only is, you know, when you look at the proposal from every which way you can look at it, there are at least half a dozen, if not a dozen ways in which the protocol could not possibly work, certainly not doable. There's no patient population anywhere in the country that would enroll. And they based it on the fact, well, you had 25,000 people in the DDI, expanded access program, you guaranteed DDI, and 10,000 people or more in the D4T, expanded access protocol, which were randomized to one dose of the drug or the other. And they figured, well, if there are that many people, you balance out 25,000 to 10,000, that's where they come up with the 18,000 figure. So they assumed that there are 18,000 people who would be in an expanded access program where you had a one-third chance of getting placebo. And the community is in an uproar on that suggestion.
Okay, also, there's a lot of electronic mail going on. We've even got your communications with Greg Gonsalves.
Yep.
It was very illuminating. Just to tell you, people are really paying attention to who's saying what and documenting it and reproducing it and getting it out across the country. And, you know, maybe I'm not, you know, I have, there's a disclaimer that all of this information is in the public domain. I'm not quite sure if every word I wrote were being distributed. I'd be very comfortable with it. But we do have, and we'll be happy to leave you a copy for your own records, communications here which make it very clear that part of TAG's agenda is a choice, okay? And the way it ties in is for expanded access below 50 T cells. That way people above 50 and up to 300 will be forced to go into large simple trials to access drug at a 50-50 chance whether it'll be drug or placebo, specifically relating to protease inhibitors.
Okay, 60.
So in terms of the rationale and why we're raising these issues, there are reasons, you know, we have things that we can give you in writing that shows that part of whether it's a deliberate plan or an unconscious bias, it appears that, first of all, below 50 T cells, in my experience, patients are the least responsive to antivirals that they're going to be. Below 50, it's very hard to get as much of an effect as possibly higher T cell counts. That's just a side editorial. We can get into all the clinical. You've got at least two primary care AIDS clinicians here who deal. I have been part of the D4T expanded access. I'm currently participating in the 3TC expanded access. They claim that it's too burdensome for people, for physicians, in terms of paperwork. I want to go on record as saying that is utter nonsense. Once a month for each patient that I'm following, I fill out 3 pages, of which 2 I just have to check, no, if there's been no change in medication, and no, if there's been no change in clinical status. And then I write down 12 parameters, white count, hemoglobin, hematocrit, platelets, etc. It takes me 10 minutes of paperwork per patient per month. So these claims that primary care clinicians cannot participate in expanded access are false. They're patently false, and I'm speaking as a physician who participates in such programs.
I want to ask them, just from listening to this, is David Robinson from New York. In response to the questions that have been asked, then, is it the FDA's position that no new standards have been either officially demanded of the drug companies or unofficially communicated to them regarding accelerated approval or large simple trials, and that this is a misperception or a misstatement on the place of the drug companies and TAG?
David, why don't you?
We have not officially. I mean, the only area where we've been aggressive in the last 6 months with the companies is with the ICC protocols, is strongly suggesting that they learn more from randomized controlled trials than they would from single consecutive trials, and they have agreed to do that. And we proposed it'll take a while to describe what we proposed to them, but they met us sort of halfway with way with that. We'd started doing that publicly at the first national task force meeting where they made their proposal, and we asked them to randomize it, and that's actually what most of our discussions have been about, is that we're skeptical of what they would learn from uncontrolled trials. I think that the, you know, the comment about preaching to the choir is that we believe that large trials have a role. I don't think we were commenting on their proposal specifically or the timing. For example, with the clarithro randomized dose trial, we were very struck by the fact that there was a survival disadvantage for the 2,000 milligram dose, just as in their small, well-controlled trial, and that was an invaluable experience to us. Some of the toxicity data has been very valuable. So that's in the sense that we believe in these very large trials. But you know, there have been many discussions of the limitations of the large simple trials and the feasibility of them, and we had those discussions as well. I think there's somewhat selective reporting, not having read their whole thing, of what they interpreted that as. There definitely are shifts going on. This is the first time since DDI that there is not an expanded access program going on in AIDS. There's not a single program going on. Companies have declined to do them with some of the new products. Sometimes, actually usually, claiming manufacturing problems.
Difficulties, yeah.
Okay, it's Diana Williamson from New York. I'm sort of new to all of this, and I'm here basically as a concerned clinician. But just to so that there won't be any more misinterpretations, can we have a yes or no answer? Has there been an official or unofficial statement or...
I wanted David to answer because his division is in touch on a day-to-day basis with the manufacturers, and I don't sit on those phone calls. So
that's Commissioner Kessler.
I apologize. but I think what David has said to you, let me speak for me, I read with great interest, for example, the Barron's article where somebody was quoted as saying that the person who developed accelerated approval should be taken out and shot. Since I consider myself to be one of the people, and I will stand up, a lot of people worked very hard on that, but since I said we will go forward and was involved in the writing of that, signed that rule, I take full responsibility for that rule, and we stand behind that 100%. There has been no change in agency policy. We are very committed to the expeditious, making available in as expeditious a fashion as possible, providing access as well as getting the data. And we are as committed to that today as we were 6 months ago, as we were 2 years ago. The good news that you should know is, I mean, you all know who you're dealing with. I mean, you know that, I mean, in some ways, I mean, this is a big organization and a big ship, and whatever you turn, we don't, I mean, for you to come in and even suggest that we can turn on a dime overnight and change policy and give us more credit, that we don't work, you know, that's not the
direction.
That's
how TAG is representing, that they have pulled off the policy-making coup of the century.
Let me tell you, because I listen very clearly. I listen very hard to what TAG, I sat in the room. There's always a problem. You try to be open, you try to be available, people want to meet. You say, sure, I'll meet, but that sometimes that raises concerns, I mean, of other people, what was said. I listened very hard. I was trying to listen to those things, that what was TAG saying? And again, I can't speak for what TAG was saying. Let me tell you what I heard, and heard not only at that meeting, but in the other articles. What are people's concerns, and what is the agency, you know, how is the agency, what should the agency do? I don't know of anybody who will advocate, of any of the decisions that we have made, any of the accelerated approval decisions we've made. I guess it really is not really four. I guess it's three of them being accelerated approval decisions. There is no one that I have heard that advocates pulling any of those drugs off the market. Okay? I have not heard that by any group. I mean, no one is saying an approval decision we made is wrong and we should yank the drug from the market. I think that is very important. So the accelerated approval decisions that we have made, I think everybody that I know of, certainly everybody, I mean, that we respect, basically says those were the right decisions. What I am hearing from some is that we may not have, when we made those decisions, have had held people's feet to the fire as much as we should have. And I think there's some misunderstanding of that, and David, Dr. Feigl can go through some of the examples. I think that we are committed to making sure at an accelerated approval, at a time of accelerated approval, as Dr. Feigl just said, we have as concretely nailed down, and in fact have an advisory committee review even the what confirmatory trials need to be done, that be part, and that be done up front.
Right.
That's what I have heard. I mean, that was...
And that was part of the regulation in the first place.
Right. But some people have said, and I asked the question, and I, if you turn off the taping, turn off the headquarters for a second. I mean, that was as always. I asked the question, the nice part of this job is there's enough yelling and screaming, and we're used to it, believe us, by everybody around us in every group. We learn in the end, no one comes here and yells, and we shift. And that's not the way we operate. We've been in this too long. In the end, I mean, the people around, yeah, we're going to listen, and we're going to try to listen very attentively. And what are we hearing?
Okay, but can I just interrupt a minute, because I think that segues into a very important point, which is that in order to listen...
This is Maxine Wolf.
Maxine Wolf from New York. In order to listen to a diversity of viewpoints, you have to be more than passively willing to meet with whomever desires to meet with you, or passively willing to put on committees only those people who make their appearance at particular times. One of the things that you're seeing here and that we have agreed on is that it is vital that if such discussions are coming up, and not just once every 6 months or once every 3 months, but if they're advisory committees, if they're anything, that what has happened has been that a narrow group of people is on every one of those committees claiming to represent a diverse community, and that it is essential and your responsibility, the FDA's responsibility, to make sure that if you see the same people twice at two meetings, you are not meeting with the diversity of the community.
Please understand, this is important enough for us, and these issues matter enough to us. We know what's going on here. Okay, we know the back and forth. We've seen the letters. We understand.
But why should...
Let me finish. And one of the... The other thing that I've heard, let me just respond to your
concern. Okay, right.
We understand, and in fact, in the past, I've gone to the East Coast, I've gone to the West Coast, to the West Coast. I mean, when I said, it was about a year ago, when I said, look, we need to sit down and reassess where we are, I mean, we must have ended up going to 14, 15, different groups, in different coalitions, to be able to talk. So we are very, give us, on that, just give us credit. We understand where people,
David, let me cut in on that, though, for a second. The last three meetings in a row of the FDA Antiviral Advisory Committee, each time had one community representative on it, and all three times they were from the same group. It was the same person, the two of them.
Well,
and how does that happen, by accident?
Well, I can also interject something. Jeff Getty, ACT UP Golden Gate. At the last antiviral committee meeting, we specifically asked to have one of our activists find as community member, because we did, in fact, put in over 2,000 man-hours of work studying, databasing, and following people on D4T. And we were told no, and that the TAG representative would be the person.
You want to just...
Who was the representative?
Craig Gonsalves.
And it's David Barr as well, or just Craig?
And David Barr was also a member of TAG, member. I mean, the overrepresentation of TAG that has gone on is something that we won't tolerate any longer. They are the sole representatives. If you have one person from the West Coast, one person from the South, and one person from New York, TAG has always been that person, and anyone else from any other group in New York need not apply. That is the message that's come down, and that's actually something that we've almost pretty much actually accepted, you know, to our failing.
Who was DVR?
David Barr, I believe.
David Barr.
Who also wears a GMHC hat, and this is part of how they do it. They'll say, well, I'm coming as GMHC, and then you find out they're really TAG.
You know,
they're wearing numbers of different hats at the same time.
Representing TAG's position as opposed to representing...
We have no desire other than... I think we've made great inroads and great strides to make sure that diverse viewpoints other than the traditional white coat scientists are sitting at those antiviral. And we want to continue doing that. And thoughtful approaches to that, I mean, we welcome. I mean, and again,